So what we're going to do this morning, we're going to get straight into looking towards the reading and then reflecting a bit. The idea is I'm going to sort of share a bit and then we're going to think a bit. You won't have to talk to the person next to you. Well, I can't guarantee that. I'm not planning that to happen. Andy was saying beforehand when we're going through the songs, is that the order we're going to sing the songs? Well, that's what we're aiming for, but who knows? So sorry already. And that's kind of how we roll. And the same when we're thinking, as we have been in the last few weeks, looking at Mark's gospel and joining in with those churches all around the world who are using the lectionary and understanding that Mark is really from the outset, from the very first verse, he wants us to know that this gospel is about Jesus. And Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, the one the Jews have been longing for. And all the rest of the evidence of Mark's gospel is not just everything Jesus did, not at all, but a carefully selected and collated and interpreted set of evidence to say, look, see for yourself, this Jesus is exactly who Jesus claims to be. And on the way, we are looking at this upside-down kingdom and looking at that as a methodology, I'm calling it, a kind of way of understanding Mark. We're not just looking at miracles or looking at the sayings of Jesus. We're looking for evidence that this kingdom is not of this world. And because of that, it will cut counter so often, so much of the time, to how the world is. And we've seen already, in the last couple of weeks, that this kingdom isn't very well aligned to the kingdom of the world. We see, in fact, it's the opposite. The weak are actually the strong ones because the humble are exalted and the proud are resisted. The outsiders find themselves insiders. The whole thing is not how the world is meant to work. And that's the evidence towards looking at Jesus being who Jesus says he is. And then last week we looked at the central claim of Christian faith, that we see God more clearly than ever when we look at Jesus. Now that may not be a kind of significant claim for you, especially if you've had faith for a long time, but it's so easy, even as Christians, perhaps especially as Christians, to disassemble God and to put God in God's constituent parts and say, well, this is Father, this is Son, this is Holy Spirit. And actually what we do when we see Jesus, we see the fullness of God in Jesus. This is what Paul talks about later in his letters. And so we need to keep in mind that this is not just a human walking about the earth. This is Jesus. When we see Jesus, we see God in the most clear way. And that needs to kind of shock us and bring us straight every now and then. And it's important that we do that. And it's particularly true when we come to look at the cross. It's very easy to put God in God's constituent parts. And on my desk, and I won't be doing it now, but after Christmas, I'm working on a new series. And one of the parts of that will be looking at the cross and saying, where is Father and Spirit in the cross? And there's some beautiful artwork that's been done. And one of those images on my desk, not an original, because I would have sold it and retired. But just a little picture of Christ on the cross and the Spirit behind Christ and the Father holding the cross, that the Trinity are present, God is present. And we're going to touch on that a tiny bit this morning, but much more after Christmas. Christmas is on its way, by the way. So today we're just having a little bit of space. We're looking at an unusual theme, perhaps. We're looking at death and greatness. Maybe not things that we would put together naturally, although culturally they go together incredibly well, not just in our culture, but in lots of different ways. And what Mark does in the reading, and we've got two readers reading the two readings, they come together in Mark's gospel. He wants us to make the comparison between Jesus' death and what it means to be great. And Mark's put them there so that we stumble across them together. Not that we stop as the paragraphs or the verses stop, but we keep reading and say, this is part of the same narrative, the same argument that Mark is wanting us to think about. But death and being great, these are things that actually go together really, really well. In Roman thought, that was a very clear thought, that the eternal glory can be achieved in the legacy we leave behind. We might be thinking about legacies. If you've seen the new RNLI advert about leaving money in your will. See that advert? Hello? No? No? Okay. You should look out for that. I zip through the adverts normally, but it's an advert and they're saying that as you, if you leave money to the lifeboats in your will, then your name will be on the side of the lifeboat You'll need your glasses on to read it, but your name will be on the lifeboats. You will always be with them. You will leave a legacy every time they go out, every time they save somebody. And that's the sense of legacy that we leave behind. Very clear in Roman thought. Julius Caesar, for example, he says this, I love the name of honor more than I fear death. And if you know anything about the history of Rome and Julius Caesar, that actually creating a legacy and greatness to live on beyond your life is very, very important in the psyche of the Roman Empire. We see the same in the Greek mindset, this concept of kleos, as they call it. The glory was something which outlives us. And maybe when we gather for funerals, we have that same sense of who we are because of the person who's died, the legacy they've left in us. It's not a bad thing. Death and legacy and greatness can continue. Or someone in the Greek view, like Ramses II, who spent his whole life preparing for death. And the tombs and the gatherings of the richness and the pyramids, all done getting ready for death. Because actually, like we often think, we only can think about life because we know it will end one day. This is one of the things that makes us human, perhaps. Or if you look at the philosophers, one of my favourite philosophers is Marcus Aurelius, who basically says, death's coming your way, so suck it up. I mean, he says it better than that, but that's kind of pretty much what he says. And he's literally being stoic about it, because he is a stoic philosopher who just says, embracing our demise, that's where we find greatness. Just embracing what's coming our way is really important. In Jewish thought, you see, I'm going round here, the cultures in Jewish thought, we see that death is very much part of the natural order of things. But greatness is very much tied up with righteousness and moral frameworks and doing the right thing. But this comes closer to what we're talking about with Jesus when we get to Psalms like Psalm 16. Have you got Psalm 16 on there? So this is written by David, but also applied to the Messiah. You will not leave my soul among the dead or allow your Holy One to rot in the grave. Abandoned to the grave, another translation says. We see that death and greatness actually go hand in hand. And this scripture, among others, was applied to the Messiah. The Messiah would somehow be outside the realms of death, somehow be protected from death. That's what was hoping for. But it's an upside-down kingdom, as I keep telling you. And the stories that we're going to read, Graham and Rachel were going to read the readings for us. They're two stories which actually really challenge how we understand greatness, especially in the context of death, and especially in the context of Jesus' death. When glory and greatness are about offering, and not about self-promotion, about giving up of yourself, not about achieving your ambitions and life goals. So we're going to read from Mark chapter 9. It's going to be on the screens. And thanks, Rachel and Graham, for reading for us.
At Mark 9:30-32, leaving that region, they travelled through Galilee. Jesus didn't want anyone to know he was there, for he wanted to spend time with his disciples and teach them. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of his enemies. He will be killed, but 3 days later he will rise from the dead." They didn't understand what he was saying. However, they were afraid to ask him what he meant.
After they arrived at Capernaum and settled in a house, Jesus asked his disciples, "What were you discussing out on the road?" But they didn't answer because they'd been arguing about which of them was the greatest. He sat down, called the 12 disciples over to him and said, "Whoever wants to be the first must take last place and be the servant of everyone else." Then he put a little child among them. Taking the child in his arms, he said to them, "Anyone who welcomes a little child like this on my behalf welcomes me. And anyone who welcomes me welcomes not only me, but also my Father who sent me."
Thank you very much. So going back to Marcus Aurelius, here's another quote. "Do not act as if you had 10,000 years to throw away death stands at your elbow. Be good for something while you live, and it's in your power. I think that's pretty good. We should have that up somewhere. You like that, Shane, do you? I do too. While you're still alive, make the most of it. Because one day, you won't be. I mean, it could be more cheery, granted, but that's kind of the basic point. Second century, very early. Second century philosophy. Death stands at your elbow. Be good for something while you live, and it's in your power. Live with your end in mind. That was Stephen Covey, I think, wasn't it? Begin with your end in mind. It's good advice. And maybe that's something about what Mark is trying to communicate to us about how Jesus is living. His life in the context of his death. Not that it nullifies his life, not at all, although the creeds are quite absent when it comes to the life of Jesus. But actually, the life of Jesus is lived knowing what the end will be. And Jesus does good, but his ultimate good he does in his death. And there were three occasions in Mark's gospel where Jesus talks about his death. The one we heard read today was the second one. Whether they were three or many occasions, or whether Mark is trying to show us, because the pattern is the same, Jesus says, I will be handed over. The disciples say, what? And Jesus explains with ever-increasing detail about what that's going to mean and what that looks like. And because we've lived with the story of Jesus, because we know death and resurrection, we know Good Friday and we know Easter Sunday, we read that back into the gospel. We've got to be careful not to do that at this stage, because the disciples sense that Jesus is the Messiah. That's just gone. They know that Jesus is the Holy One of God. And they know because of the teachings about the Messiah that this Messiah is the one sent from God, the Holy One. And Psalms like Psalm 16 say that death will not touch him and will not abandon you to the grave, the psalmist says. So for Jesus to talk about death and be the Messiah, it's not that they're dim-witted. It's like a category error. It doesn't compute. If Jesus is going to be the Messiah, then how can death touch him? How can he talk about his death? What is he even meaning about that? It doesn't make any sense. How can Jesus be a conquering hero if he dies like everybody else does? He might do some good, like Marcus Aurelius encourages us to do good, but at the end of the day, he will die. So what's the point? How does it work? It's another example of how different the kingdom of God is with the kingdom of the world. And just wanted to pause there, because it kind of made me think, and I want to make you think, about the ways in which God doesn't do stuff the way God should. We could spend a whole series, couldn't we, talking about that? The ways in which God should act, but God doesn't act. Or where we think, according to our kingdom and our values and our ways, what God should do. The disciples thought that Jesus shouldn't be talking about death because, after all, he is, they hope, the Messiah. But there are times in which, even as seasoned Christians, when God does things that God shouldn't do, or perhaps more especially, God doesn't do things we think God should do if we were in charge. The American theologian Ligon Duncan says this: there is a God we want and a God who is, and the two are not the same. I love that too. We need some more posters up around the place. A Casting Crown song has a very similar sentiment in one of their songs, Called to the Middle, it's called. It says this. Next slide. With eyes wide open to the differences, the God we want and the God who is. So let's just stop for a moment. And if this were cafe church, it would lead to a very awkward conversation, but it's not. So let's be thoughtful for a moment and just be still before God and just say, where are the areas where God isn't what God should be for you? Dare we say where we might be disappointed with what God does or God doesn't do, with what God allows or doesn't act, how God doesn't act? Are there ways in which God is different from what we want or hope for or long for? Let's just spend a moment in quietness, talk to the Lord about these things. And as we think about those things, maybe that makes us a little bit more understanding of the disciples. That they had in mind this conquering hero who won't stop talking about his own demise. And it feels painful, it feels like an awkward elephant in the room. You're meant to be great, all conquering, you're meant to be our hero. Will you stop talking about death? Because there is ultimately no greatness in death. And it makes us more sensitive perhaps to what was going on in this story, or in the stories like it, when we're so quick to judge the disciples for being so slow, when chances are we would be right alongside them, asking the self-same questions. And it's hard for them, perhaps less hard for us, because we know how the story works out, but hard for them to believe that Jesus would offer himself, that he would somehow be victim and yet in control. Again, that's something from the upside down kingdom. But as he does so, as he starts articulating what his death looks like, what it would be for him to be given up, it once again blows out of the water how we understand the purposes of God, how we understand power especially. And what it means for somebody who has power to give it up for others. And it made me think of this image from 1989. I couldn't believe it was such a long time ago. Do you remember this image? And actually there's a little video I hadn't seen before, the news clip of this Chinese protester in Tiananmen Square. And how, as the tanks try and go round him, he moves and gets in their way. That takes some courage, right? You stand there first, like, I made my point, off you go. But no, every time the tank moves, he moves. And there's something incredibly powerful. Those tanks could have rolled him over and they wouldn't even have felt the bump. But they don't. Because there's something incredibly powerful about a man who says, you can take my life, but if I lay it down, your power goes. If I offer you my life, I retain the power. You have no power over me. And I wonder whether that's something about what we need to capture about what Jesus is saying about death and greatness. About offering himself. That we need to perhaps understand when we think about the death of Christ is coming down the story in Mark, and we'll get to that. That it's not some sacrifice that Jesus makes to change God's mind about us. It's the sacrifice that Jesus makes to change our mind about God. Because we've been thinking already that we see God most clearly when we see Jesus. This is about Jesus showing us who God truly is. Not about Jesus standing in the way for us. Because still in our day to day, just have to watch the news in the last 24 hours. We know that death is the ultimate punishment. The ones with the most guns win. The one who has the power to take life is the winner. And the crucifixion then becomes not what God inflicts upon Jesus in order to forgive us. The crucifixion is what God in Jesus endures as God forgives us. The cross is where God absorbs our sin and recycles it into forgiveness. And if we think further on in the story, that God is not a high priest like Caiaphas who seeks a sacrifice. He's not like Pilate who wants an execution and just the day to go more smoothly. God is like Jesus, absorbing sin, forgiving sinners, bringing into himself all the sin and evil of the world. There's a long quote in the growth group notes, and I hope you'll spend some time on it because it's dynamite. I've already trimmed it down. It's from Rowan Williams. His little book on Mark's Gospel is a delight. If you want to read anything on Mark's Gospel for this series, that's the little book. And I've forgotten the name of it, something about Mark. But this is just creative. Huh? But Rowan Williams says this, Jesus is saying that his execution is the price that is paid to free us once and for all from the fantasy that God's power is just like ours, only a hugely inflated version, a matter of what we would do if we were lucky enough to be running the universe. The death of Jesus is the price paid to abolish and uproot that fantasy. So to see the cross in terms of power and greatness, and especially when we're thinking about death today, the God in Jesus does not accept the premise that the one who has the power to kill is the one who has ultimate power. Because that's the way the world works, and God turns his back on that. And firstly, we see it in the way that the disciples don't get it. It feels like, well, they were expecting a Messiah to be triumphant, and Jesus is saying, but this is what triumph looks like. It looks like offering yourself. It looks like disarming the powers by saying, I'm not playing by those rules. I will stand in the way of the tank and say, I lay my life down. The power you have has gone. And that's, I think, where we get to with the next bit, when it comes to the what it means to be great. When we have the next reading that Graham read, this illustration, perhaps, not about how good it is to serve each other, though that's really good and very important, but about the illustration about what it means for Jesus to give his life for us. The death and greatness go hand in hand, but with the kingdom, it's not in the way we think it's going to be. Now, some scholars suggest that what they were arguing about was, well, if Jesus goes, who's going to take his place? Who's going to be in charge when he's gone? I don't buy that myself. Because they're terrified. They're following the Messiah. If the Messiah goes, what does that mean? But he wants us, Mark, to understand this greatness is probably more likely, I think, changing the subject. Getting into a spat, like siblings do. And it seems to me, knowing from, well, perhaps children that are near to me, that doesn't matter how old they go, when they come home, they just start finding their place again, like they did when they were teenagers. Is that new to anyone? No. Okay, not just my family, okay. And maybe the disciples are doing a similar thing here, trying to find their pecking order, trying to find their way and say, what does it mean to be great in this kind of kingdom of God? And Mark shines a light on the death of Jesus by talking about what it means to be great in the kingdom. And it's about power again. It's about the world, not the world's power or the world's practices, but about what's all about gain and control, but about giving up of oneself, about mercy, not sacrifice. The world operates in gain and control, where the strongest are in charge. And I think, and this is a thought that I had, that we could explore perhaps another time, I think historically the church has tried to do the same thing. With better motives, we've tried to use the power of the world in the way the world does for good stuff. And I think Jesus points us to something completely different here, about other people, about what's right for others, not what's right for us. Not like playing the same game, but with better motives, but playing a different game completely. But that's for another day. So he takes a child. This powerless child has no agency in the culture, has no rights, seemingly nothing. And said, this is how you should be. This child, exactly what it means to be great. Not engaging with the world as the world is, but playing by a different set of rules. Even in our relationship with power. It's a huge challenge, a huge challenge. And it made me think of this image. It made me think of Greta Thunberg, who, I mean, before all this with Trump, at 15, she stood outside the Swedish parliament to say, enough already. This is not going anywhere near far enough in terms of our response to the climate crisis. And she got famous for that, and she started striking, and her schoolmates started striking with her and said, we want a better future. And that's how it snowballs. And you see in that image an amazing sort of juxtaposition of power there. The most powerful man in the world and the one who just gets under his skin. Because she's powerless. She has no power. She's talking about different terms of power. And I wonder whether that's something that illustrates what's in Jesus' mind. The one who seems to have no power, but actually has ultimate power because they're willing to lay down their lives for others. I think that's what Jesus is pointing to. That's what the kingdom is like. Now, when we're preparing for today and I was thinking a bit about the different cultures and how they respond to death and greatness, it made me sort of get into sort of philosophy mode, I'm afraid. Most of it I've left at home, you'll be glad to know. But I wanted to keep hold of Thespis's ship. Does anyone know about Thespis's ship? Okay, great. So I can make it up a bit. No. So this is an image of Theseus, who was this kind of mythical hero. I'm not saying he existed, but what the story is, I think, is really helpful. And he had this ship. If you are a philosophy major, then I'm sorry, I'm about to butcher the story, but this is kind of how I understand it. He's going in and out for hundreds of years to Athens with the young of Athens in his ship. And as the ship gets older, it starts rotting and falling apart, right? They do that. And so every time a plank were ruined, he would toss it overboard and replace it with a new plank, right? And eventually, every plank on board is replaced. And so in what sense is it Theseus's ship? Because it's not anymore, right? It's a thought experiment about who we are and how we change. And if you were feeling really brave, you could say, well, imagine you were in a dinghy behind, and you, every time that Theseus threw over a plank, you picked up the plank and you made a boat out of it. Would that not be Theseus' ship? Which one is the real one? Now, I think it's a really interesting stuff that I spend my time thinking about, and it might explain a lot about why I'm the way I am. But when I think about faith, it makes me feel about sometimes we need to reimagine stuff too. And sometimes we're fearful of doing that. That we look at planks in our lives and think, I'm not sure that plank serves me anymore. It's rotten and needs replacing with a different plank. And so we do that, and we do it with confidence, knowing that we are sailing, to push the analogy too far, we're sailing into wisdom, we're sailing into new life, we're sailing into the ways of God. We're still the person we are. God is making us and remaking us and shaping us. And part of the process of the preaching and the listening and the reflecting and the growth groups is to say, like today, these themes of death and greatness, about what it means for Jesus to lay down his life and how we would respond to that, how does that impact our lives? Are there any planks that need to be looked at, that need to be thrown overboard and replaced with a more gospel-looking plank? And today, I think, again, we see once more this upside-down kingdom, that it deeply challenges us, because I think so often we have just adopted the ways of power and greatness of this world and just try to sort of Christianize them by being nicer or by having better motives. But the gospel seems to be saying, no, it's opposite. It's not what the world is like. It's actually completely different. And that will take a whole lot of energy and reimagination and a community to work out what that means and what it looks like to resist power as the world understands it, and to live in humility and service. And that raises loads of questions. Well, how do we do that without being taken advantage of? And is it okay if we are taken advantage of? And what does it mean about our lives and our deaths? And how does it all fit together? These are the questions that you'll be looking at on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of growth groups, to how this lands in our lives, how to seek first God's kingdom. Try not to bend our kingdom or the kingdom of the world into what we think might be God's shape, but to allow the upside down kingdom to inform us. So let's be quiet for a moment. I'd like to read you a prayer by Thomas Merton. But before we do, let's be quiet. And maybe just think around these thoughts. You don't have to come to any conclusions, but maybe just to think about how death and greatness, how Jesus' sacrifice, him offering of himself, how different that is to what the world expects, how different it is to what the church has done, and where it might land with us in terms of if there are any planks in our ship that need replacing. If there's any ways in which we sense the Spirit asking us to trust in a different way or to think new thoughts. Thomas Merton prays, O God, we are one with you. You have made us one with you. You have taught us that if we are open to one another, you will dwell in us. Help us to preserve this openness and to fight for it with all our hearts. Help us to realize that there can be no understanding where there is mutual rejection. O God, in accepting one another wholeheartedly, fully, completely, we accept you. And we thank you. And we adore you. And we love you with our whole being. Because our being is in your being. Our spirit is rooted in your spirit. Fill us then with love. And let us be bound together with love as we go our diverse ways, united in this one spirit which makes you present in the world and which makes you witness the ultimate reality that is love. Love has overcome. Love is victorious. Amen.